We're on the record. I'm Sheila Cast. Good morning. It's been 6 years since the Baltimore Police Department and the U.S. Department of Justice entered into a consent decree to address unconstitutional practices, including illegal stops and searches, excessive force, and the disproportionate arrest of African-American residents of Baltimore. What progress has been made? Where does the BPD stand in adopting new practices and retraining officers? Joining us for an update is Kenneth Thompson, a partner at the law firm Venable LLP. He is the consent decree's monitor. To do this work, Thompson leads a team of experts in police reform, civil rights enforcement, and community engagement. Kenneth Thompson, welcome back to the show.
Good morning.
And also with us is Seth Rosenthal, deputy monitor of the consent decree. Welcome, Seth.
Thank you.
And Evan Shea, a former prosecutor and legal subject matter expert on the team. Welcome.
Thank you for having us.
Kenneth Thompson, what is your assessment of how far the Baltimore Police Department has come in reforming its policies and practices?
I think the department has made significant strides from 2017 to the present. They have revamped their policies, which is critical to a police department. And just as important, if not more importantly, they have really put in place some really, really good training. And so those two things really lay a good foundation for the reason why I say this department has gone and come a long way. Now, about, 2 years ago, the judge made it clear that he wanted the monitoring team to switch our roles just a little bit. In the first 4 years, we spent a great deal of our time providing what's called technical assistance. And along with DOJ, we would help the department revise its policies and do its training. Well, over the last 2 years, we have really been focusing on assessing the department. And what I mean by that is, you know, at some point it's important to learn whether all the time spent by DOJ, the monitoring team, BPD, and the city, whether all the time spent developing policies and training, whether it's paying off. And so where we are now is in the point where we are now doing assessments. And I will say to you this, I think that when I look at this department today, they have some of the best training in the country. I think that their policies certainly are among best practices. But when I look at trying to assess where a department is, I mean, and this is just Ken Thompson speaking, there are a couple of areas that I just look at as being core to the overall mission of the consent decree, which of course is to build some level of trust back between the community and the police department. And those areas are the areas that I look at where the police and the community have the greatest interactions. And that would be use of force, that would be stops, search, and arrest. That would be interactions with people who have behavioral issues, and finally interactions with youth. And so if I start with, and I'm just using this as an example in terms of why I think the department has done so well. When we look at use of force, and I'm gonna ask Seth to talk a little bit about that. The use of force area has, the department has really made tremendous strides. We did an assessment starting in 2018 before the training took place up through 2021. And there has been a 54, almost 55% decrease in use of force cases. That's incredible. I'm going to ask Evan to talk a little bit about the other area that I think is important, and that has to do with arrest. That's the second area that we are actually in the process now of the reports that have to be passed around to the parties. But I think that we're finding that even in that area that things are moving quite well.
Let me pick up on what you said about use of force. Mm-hmm. Seth, would you first remind us what the levels of force are that are discussed?
Sure. So the way that the Baltimore Police Department defines use of force, as you suggest, is by levels. Level one uses of force are the least serious use of force. To take a for instance, you know, you have somebody who's about to be arrested and runs from the police, and the police have to tackle that person in order to put them into custody. The person doesn't suffer any injuries, but a minimal amount of force necessary to bring the person under control was used. Level two use of force is the next most serious level, and that's where the person has suffered some injury or the officer does something active, like has to use fists, punching somebody in the stomach in order to bring them in, under control, has to use a control hold to bring them under control, might have to deploy a taser or OC spray in order to bring them under control, that's a level two use of force. A level three use of force is the most serious use of force. That's deadly force. That involves firing a gun. That involves a strike to the head or the sternum or the neck, a part of the body where a blow could actually cause significant injury or death.
And Kenneth Thompson told us, the monitor told us, that use of force incidents have declined by 54, almost 55%. Does that show up in all three levels of use of force down that much?
So it shows up most prominently in level one and level two uses of force. Level three uses of force, which is a very small percentage of uses of force every year, you know, roughly between 20 and 30 incidents, you know, of over generally, well, again, the number has declined precipitously over the course of the last several years. As Ken said, between 2018 and 2021, the number of uses of force, the percentage decreased by 54.7%, or from over 1,500 incidents to under 700. But less than 30 of those every year are level three uses of force. The number of level three uses of force has stayed relatively constant, you know, over the period of the consent decree. But overall force has decreased by a lot. And significantly, not only has force decreased by a lot, but certain types of force have decreased by a lot. So for instance, officers pointing weapons at people, which can be obviously a terrifying experience for folks, has diminished by more than half. That's a level one use of force because it doesn't involve the actual deployment of a gun. In addition, both officers and individuals, citizens, are injured or being injured less. There was a drop in the number of subjects injured by use of force between 2018 and 2021 of over 40%. And a number, the percentage of officers injured in use of force incidents declined by almost 30% in the same period.
So
those are all positive trends.
But what still needs to be, where is improvement still needed?
Improvements are needed in two principal areas, which we point out in the comprehensive report that we published at the beginning of the year. First, although we found in the mine run of cases, the vast, vast majority of cases, upwards of 95% of cases, officers, when they used force, used it appropriately, meaning they used force that was reasonable, necessary, and proportionate to the threat posed. In level three, and when they used level three uses of force, the most serious uses of force, they did not do it nearly as much. So we need to see more responsible level three uses of force. Fortunately, in none of those level three uses of force that we found to be inappropriate or violative of policy, was anybody seriously injured or killed. So that's a good thing. But that doesn't mean that the force used, the serious force used, was appropriate, because it wasn't. So we found a handful of cases each year where level three uses of force were not appropriate and not within policy. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that we found supervisory review of uses of force to continue to be deficient. In the small minority of cases where we found the use of force to have violated policy, supervisors weren't catching it and supervisors weren't correcting it. That's a problem, because where the rubber meets the road is supervisors correcting violations of policy. And when we found force used that was out of policy, supervisors generally weren't correcting it.
That's Seth Rosenthal, deputy monitor of the consent decree involving the Baltimore Police Department and the U.S. Justice Department, here on The Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Also with us is the monitor, Kenneth Thompson, and Evan Shea, a legal expert on the team. Evan, you're in the process of reviewing how the police department conducts arrests.
Yes, thank you, Sheila. We are currently not finished, but in the process, we are finished the assessment, but not finished the final reporting on our assessment of performance with arrests. That is part of a broader subject that involves stops, searches, and arrests. Arrests are only the instances where an officer finds probable cause to believe that a crime has occurred and takes an individual into custody to charge them with a crime. We're also assessing stops, which is involve investigatory stops or investigatory reasons when a crime that has not necessarily yet been determined to be have been committed, and also searches where someone's person, house, or vehicle are searched as an investigative step, but not where a crime has been found sufficient to charge. So those assessments of those other two areas are coming later. But with respect to arrests, we have reviewed a sample of arrests that were made by the BPD and analyzed whether there was sufficient probable cause. That's the legal standard required for law enforcement to arrest and charge someone.
And are you seeing a trend?
There is a trend, and there are two important things, at least the early returns. Again, we're not done the report, but the trend we're seeing is twofold. One, we looked at two time periods. One, in 2019, which was before a lot of the excellent training and policy revisions that Ken talked about earlier were put into place. And then we looked at after that the training was instituted, the period of 2021, that year. And what we saw was a marked decrease in arrests where we found probable cause lacking, which if a probable cause is lacking, that's an illegal arrest. We saw a marked decrease from 2019 to 2021, and overall very good numbers in 2021 in terms of overall numbers of illegal arrests or the percentage of those arrests out of the total number of arrests. So that's one good trend. The other good trend is that when the Department of Justice investigated the BPD in the investigation that led to the consent decree, they found a lot of what I'll call purposeful, structural, and very intentional from supervisory levels tactics that really incorporated illegal arrests, what many folks colloquially refer to as clearing corners, where supervisors would send officers out simply to move citizens off of street corners or areas they saw as high crime, really whether or not there was probable cause, or very loosely assessing whether there was probable cause. And that's really what the Department of Justice found was so troubling. In all the instances where we found, at least in our sample, probable cause to be lacking, it was fairly apparent that it was simply a mistake by the officer. The officer honestly thought he or she had probable cause, but they didn't. And while that's negligent and not a good thing, it's a very different category of error than the more purposeful, strategic problems that the DOJ was finding.
Seth, what would you add?
One of, or among the many deficiencies that the Justice Department found, you know, we're not just in the area of arrests, but in stops and searches too. And, you know, we have not been able to conduct an assessment of stops and searches yet because BPD had to develop entirely new technology, an entirely new IT platform. And although that IT platform, that new record management system has been implemented and was implemented almost 2 years ago, it is still not capturing all the data it needs to capture for us and for BPD itself to be able to do everything the consent decree requires us to do to evaluate the constitutionality of stops and searches. We're almost there, but there have been some bumps along the road.
We need to take a quick break here on the record. Seth Rosenthal is deputy monitor of the consent decree of the Baltimore Police Department. Seth, thank you.
Thanks for having me, Sheila. Appreciate it.
Kenneth Thompson, monitor of the Baltimore Police Department's consent decree, and Evan Shea, a member of the monitoring team, will stick with us. Short break on the record. When we're back, the consent decree started 6 years ago. When will it be lifted? I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us. Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. How far has the Baltimore Police Department come in implementing the federal reforms required by the consent decree? Since 2017, an independent team has worked to oversee the implementation of these reforms, designed to ensure that police behavior and practices comply with the Constitution. I'm speaking with Kenneth Thompson, the court-appointed monitor of how the consent decree is working. Also with us is Evan Shea, a legal expert on the monitoring team. The monitoring team recently published a report on sexual assault investigations. Evan, remind us what the Justice Department said in 2016 about how the Baltimore Police Department handled sexual assault cases.
What the DOJ found in 2016 was BPD had two significant issues with their approach to sexual assault investigations. The first was gender bias. They found that the investigators investigating the those crimes showed a distinct bias against women, which influenced the way that the investigation was conducted. And the second was that they consistently underinvestigated reports of sexual assault, and the investigations, when they were conducted, did not reflect best practices to get to the bottom of the crime and hold those accountable who were involved.
So, Evan, as I understand it, the monitoring team looked at cases in 2018, from 2018, 2019, and 2020. What did you find?
Well, Sheila, if you notice those years, those were really the early years of the consent decree. So what we did was essentially what we called a baseline audit, because none of the training and policy revisions, again, that Ken talked about earlier on, had been put into place. So it is a baseline to work from. Not surprisingly, we found there's a lot of improvement that needs to happen within the department. They need to continue to update their investigative practices. Most importantly, their record management and record keeping practices need significant improvement. They need to continue to work on their interactions with victims and other witnesses. They need to update their interview techniques to incorporate modern practices and best practices around the country. And they need to continue to work on oversight of the investigations, which is a common theme throughout the areas in the consent decree, but particularly important with sexual assault investigations.
Kenneth Thompson, let me shift gears and ask you about staffing. When we spoke with Commissioner Michael Harrison last week, he noted the police department is understaffed by about 500 officers. The department already is offering new recruits a signing bonus, housing allowance for officers who live in the city, and assistance with student loans. What more will it take to improve hiring and fill these vacancies?
Let me say this about staffing, because we cannot overstate how critical that deficiency is and how critical it is that it be addressed. I mean, staffing affects everything in the police department, from solving murders down to community policing. And community policing, of course, is the primary tool that the consent decree is designed around to attempt to rebuild trust between the department and the community that it serves. And so one of the things in the consent decree, which of course is trying to drive home how important engagement is there was a requirement that police spend 60% of their time answering calls for service, but 40% of their time engaging with the community. And in order to engage with the community, you've got to have enough police officers who can do this. And the problem with staffing is that it not only affects the ability of this department to come out from under federal supervision, but it also means that the good work that the department is doing is really not being translated down to the street as quickly as it should be, because you just don't have enough police officers walking around explaining to people and showing people. It's really more than explaining. You need the police to walk around and show people that this is not the same department that it was in 2015, 2016, and 2017, that it's a new reformed department. And so that problem is going to have to be fixed. Now, as you mentioned, you know, Baltimore City now has the highest paid entry level for police officers. They've got all kinds of tuition reimbursement programs. They've got housing allowances. So what more can this department do? Well, you know, I'm not sure. They've got to figure that out, because until and unless they do that, they will not be able to come out from under, as I indicated before, under federal supervision. And the biggest problem is that I don't think they'll be able to do the kind of engagement that is going to be necessary, so the citizens of Baltimore will recognize and understand that this department is a new department and much different than what it was, again, back in the Freddie Gray days.
That's Kenneth Thompson, the court-appointed monitor of the federal consent decree over the Baltimore Police Department, here on The Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Also with us is Evan Shea, a member of the monitoring team. Last month, an officer shot a 17-year-old in southwest Baltimore. The teen now faces assault and gun charges. When officers are involved in a shooting, how does the department assure that the trust it's been working so hard to strengthen between the community and the police doesn't erode?
That is a very good question. And I think the primary response is that the department needs to be transparent. And so, as you undoubtedly saw from the beginning, the body-worn camera footage was put out. And ultimately, what will happen, the monitoring team, and we don't address or assess these things until the end of the day. And what I mean by that is we wait for the department to complete its investigation, to get all the facts. And we will then review what the department has done in terms of holding police officers accountable, because this is another big part of the consent decree, which is misconduct and discipline, that is, whether police can police themselves. We will do an intense, comprehensive review of not only this particular situation and investigation, but a series of investigations that we will look at over time, and we will provide the public with our view in terms of whether we think the department has changed to the point where it's no longer a department that existed back in the Gun Trace Task Force days and is now a new department that adequately and accurately and fairly looks at police officers and holds them accountable when they need to be held accountable.
There is not a specific end date to the consent decree. New Orleans has been under its consent decree for a decade. How do you see the timeline ahead?
Well, let's put it this way. The department and the city will dictate when the consent decree is no longer around. The federal judge and the federal court will exercise supervision over this department until they have met all 16 of the areas in the consent decree. And that's really up to the department. Now, you know, we being the Department of Justice and the monitoring, we work very closely with this department. We try to help them. For example, we've done 13 assessments already. I think we have another 8 or 9 scheduled to do this year. We try to give them a blueprint in terms of, look, guys, this is what you've got to do to complete this area. That's what we will continue to do. My view is that, you know, there will be some areas, hopefully this year, they will come into compliance. And then there's another 2 years that is added on top of that, Sheila, because it's not only enough that they show that they're complying with the requirements of the consent decree now, but they've got to show what's called sustained compliance. And under the consent decree, that's a 2-year period. So when you ask me how much longer is it going to take, it's going to take a few years. I can't tell you when. And again, a lot of it is dictated by, you know, how fast this department is able to reform itself.
And what is the monitoring team going to be focused on in the near term?
Yeah, we are currently looking at a major assessment in terms of how the police interact with people who have behavioral disorders or in behavior crisis. We're also doing a very deep dive, comprehensive assessment of the entire misconduct and discipline strategy. And that is whether or not police are being appropriately held accountable when they violate policy or otherwise engage in misconduct. So that's just two of the major issues that we're going to be looking at this year. We're going to review use of force again this year, because I'm hoping that they were pretty close when we looked at them last year. And if they, you know, follow the blueprint, you know, hopefully that area will be one where they might be in full complete, what we call full compliance. And of course, the 2-year period would start from then.
I'm grateful to you for this update. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Kenneth Thompson, a partner at the law firm Venable LLP, is the court-appointed monitor of the Baltimore Police Department's federal consent decree. Evan Shea, a former prosecutor, is a legal subject matter expert on the monitoring team. At the On the Record page at WIPR.org, we have links to the monitoring team's reports, as well as the Baltimore Police Department's transparency page, where public feedback is accepted. I'm Sheila Cass. Glad you're with us on the record. Come back tomorrow.